This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Writer Amy Hempel's reputation is vast and complicated. She's a famous teacher at Bennington, Sewanee, and Harvard, among other places, and a famous student. She spent years under the tutelage of Gordon Lish, the editor and teacher who shepherded the career of Raymond Carver. She's been called a minimalist, but her work has also been praised as radiant and even lush. She's known for her wit, both on the page and in person, and yet her stories are profoundly serious. And she has a reputation for being gracious, but a number of articles about her begin with the sentence, "Amy Hempel doesn't like interviews." So at the risk of ruining my career, I'm going to say, welcome back, Amy Hempel, to The State of Things. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. I am happy to be here.
You are. And, you know, we did talk with you by phone a while back, and it was wonderful.
Yes.
Why do you don't hate interviews. What is it about them?
Oh, I just get self-conscious. You know, one doesn't think one is the most interesting candidate necessarily, but I...
Well, is there something, I mean, you're teaching writing too, and there's always something, I mean, when I sit on this side of the mic and ask these questions of writers, kind of what's going through your mind and how do you write this thing? And I'm thinking, if I had to answer that, I would just stand up and walk out. I don't know what I was thinking. I was at a word processor and these are the words that came to mind,
yeah.
Frank. How do I answer that question? You know?
Yeah. Well, I think of the words that come out as coming sideways. I mean, they often come when I'm not looking, in effect. I'm doing something else. And with me, it's usually something dog-related, something dog-centric that will spark a story.
You love animals.
I do.
You almost became a veterinarian.
Except for organic chemistry.
Ooh, that
Oops.
Close.
Yeah.
Were you at that moment? Now, so you're here you are planning to be a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. You're going to school and the science upends you.
Yes.
Were you crushed? I mean, were you then, what am I going to do? Was it all over for you at that moment?
No. I loved human anatomy and the pre-med courses I did were fascinating, but it was the chemistry, the organic chemistry that cashiered that plan. And then, but it's worked out. I've always combined some kind of animal work with the writing and teaching of writing. So it worked out fine.
It worked out. How did you figure out that you would be a writer? When did that occur to you?
That was always there in tandem with the interest in veterinary medicine. Always reading, always wanting to write, but not starting until relatively late when I was in my late 20s.
You and did you set out to be a short story writer?
Yes. That's always what interested me, what I wanted to do. That's what I mostly read. I knew it was that form. I never wanted to write a novel, although people often think writing short stories is a rehearsal for a novel. It's an entirely different form with different requirements and different rewards.
You never wanted to write a novel?
No, I love reading them, but it's just not in me to – I don't experience life in on that scale. I'm attracted to moments, single moments in which something, usually something between people, shifts. Perhaps a power shifts, and that interests me endlessly. And I've not exhausted the possibilities of story, what stories can do, or short stories can do.
Do your stories start there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or with language, a phrase maybe that I've overheard. I know that a lot of writing teachers assign their students a kind of eavesdropping exercise, and I think there's some use to that.
You studied under Gordon Lish.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from him?
I learned that it was not about talent, it was will that determined who would be able to write or not. You know, forget talent, you know. It was who wants it the most. That's the person who's going to make this happen and be able to do it.
Who wants what?
Oh, to be able to write a story that matters.
Is that it? Because if you talk to writers, they all seem to want to be read, right?
Yes.
That's important.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that means to a certain extent to be successful. You want to be well known,
mm-hmm.
right? And there are people who want that. I mean, but it sounds like there's a difference between simply wanting to be well-known and having something that you need to say.
Yes, it was entirely about the latter. And I remember him saying, oh, you need three things, obsession, nerve, and ground worth reporting on. And I that's held up, for example. I think that still is accurate. And his attention to language, writing at the sentence level, the basic unit of construction for fiction is the sentence. And so I learned to write at the sentence level.
And also, was it true that there is an exercise that maybe your first exercise to talk about your deepest secret?
Your worst secret.
Your worst secret.
The thing that you would never live down, the thing that dismantles your sense of yourself. And that was the only assignment when I took his class for the first time at Columbia. And it resulted in my first short story, in the cemetery where Al Jolson is buried.
Now, I know that you've already told the secret, so you're not too shy about telling it again.
No, not at all. Well, at the time, my worst secret was that I felt I'd failed my best friend when she was dying. So that was the story that I wrote that I would not have written, I'm sure, were it not for that that requirement.
Do you get at your... I mean, when I read that, I was fascinated by that and wondered if you really get at your deepest or your worst secret.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are you satisfied that that's really it, or do we sometimes just never tell ourselves our worst secret?
Well, that's an interesting thing to think about. I felt at the time, I'll qualify it that way, at the time that was very much, it was very clear to me that was the thing I felt I could never live down.
And you said earlier that he said this dismantles your mm-hmm. own self-image.
Yes. Sort of,
what good is that? Why does that help a writer?
Well, on the page, what happens is that if a writer, say a narrator, convicts herself on the page in a piece of fiction, oddly, the reader finds that appealing and winning and is on that character's side.
Now, there are ways to tell a secret and ways not to, ways in which you can conceal more than you reveal in the openness. So do you have to work at it? Do you have to work at being really honest? Once you've gone through that mm-hmm. first hurdle, I've said it out loud.
Yeah.
But then there's how you say it. There's how you sort of try to pose in the story
that
you tell about yourself.
Well, I think that's where nerve comes in, you know, because here's the thing about writing. If you don't go deep down, the next writer will, and that is the person people would rather read. That's the person who'll be read.
You are also well known as a voracious reader as well as a writer. Are your students reading these days? Do they read a lot?
They have to. But they do it happily, I think.
You're here at North Carolina, kind of a homecoming for you in some ways.
Yes. I spent a semester teaching at Duke in, I think, the spring of 2000. And I have some good pals here, good writer friends here.
You know, there's been a lot of talk these days about MFA programs, mm-hmm. wondering if fine arts can be taught, can mm-hmm. reading be taught.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing it, so apparently you think it can.
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. That was never a question. And, you know, I've just, one sees it happen so many times, even the least likely possibilities. You can teach people how to hear, pay attention to hearing differently or seeing past what everyone else is seeing to something that will be useful.
Do you write for the ear?
Oh, I do, yeah. I think most writers do read or should read their work aloud as they go, because you can hear things, awkward things you can't always identify on the page.
But there are. I mean, there are literary constructions, things that you would mm-hmm. use in writing that you probably wouldn't say or write in a speech.
I don't know. I like to bring a poet's concerns to fiction. I read a lot of poetry, or very precise kinds of prose to get myself going.
You started out in writing in journalism, or at mm-hmm. least you did that early on.
Yeah.
And I saw that you felt that journalism, that was a safer place. They had rules. Since then, you've learned that there are rules for fiction as well.
But maybe fewer rules. Mm. Maybe fewer. I mean, it is good to remember, it's helpful to remember that even fiction, made-up stuff, is logical, or better, fiction has a kind of internal logic. So I think of logic as opposed to rules maybe more.
Are there things you can learn from journalism or things that apply?
Sure. Don't write towards the story. Start with it. You know, just start with it. Don't weigh it down with extraneous stuff. That's maybe the most helpful, most immediate transfer. Yeah.
So journalists, you've learned from them. Stand-up comics, you've learned from them.
Yes. Timing, inflection. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, again, gets to that poetic sense, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes. I think there's a lot in common there, actually. And I remember reading a couple of years ago, Steve Martin published his autobiography, I think Born Standing Up, and there's an amazing bit in there that's very applicable to writing fiction, where he says, if you abandon the punchline, if you don't tell somebody where to laugh, which is what he did in his early act, people will find what's funny and laugh on their own. And he felt that was a more successful, more rewarding, more honest even exchange.
How does that, what does that mean, abandon the punchline?
Well, I used to go to see him perform in clubs, comedy clubs in California. And he, you know, his act early on he didn't tell jokes. He just was funny. And because you didn't have punchlines coming, it was just mesmerizing. There was uneasy laughter and then growing genuine laughter, and it was much more satisfying.
You have a great story to tell, in fact, seeing him backstage one time, I believe.
Well, yeah, I got into a show at the boarding house in San Francisco, and I was with a comedian friend, and we went back to the green room, and Steve Martin had gone on sick that night, very sick, and I said, I really admire what you did. I mean, I couldn't have gone out there. I couldn't go out there, you know, and do that if I was sick. And he said, well, you couldn't do it if you were well, which was entirely true.
That's a pretty good punchline. And yeah. There it is right there.
There it is.
And that I think gets to the improvisational nature of stand-up as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. your sense that because you would watch comics night after night kind of mm-hmm. do the same material.
Yeah. And one night it would just bomb and one night it would work. And it was as simple, literally as simple as the inflection put on a different syllable. So that carries over into writing as well.
You've moved around a little bit, born in mm-hmm. Chicago, lived in New York, admire Southern writers greatly.
Mm-hmm. And California.
Been around. Does that help? Does that help to move around, or do you feel that you need to be anchored in a place to write?
I don't feel anchored. I mean, when I'm in the South, which isn't often enough, I feel this is where I belong, and I do.
What is it about the South? Why?
Oh gosh. Partly it's the language. It's the kindness. It's the history. It's the resilience. I was in New Orleans last year for about a week that just undid me in wonderful ways.
Why?
Well, in New Orleans, it was certainly the resilience and the humor in the face of recovering from the storm, as the locals mm-hmm. call it. Very moved by that, even that many years after.
You talked about wanting to hear the poetry and to put a kind of poetic sensibility into your short stories. Mm-hmm. What poets do you admire?
Well, I love Sharon Olds, Marie Howe. There is a just an electrifying poet near Detroit, Michigan, named John Rabicki, Dean Young. There's a poet named Brian Turner who served in Iraq, and his first book, Here Come a Bullet, mm-hmm. has a lot to do with that, and it's very, very, very strong. These are just a few.
I know your practice involves knowing the last line of the story before you start.
Yes. Have to know where I'm going. Not how to get there, but where I end up.
So, I mean, it's sort of interesting because you start at this point of disequilibrium, right, this mm-hmm. power shift, mm-hmm. the fault line. Mm-hmm. But you also have to know the end of the story.
Yeah, I do. And the couple of times, and it's only been a couple of times that I've tried to write a story without knowing at the start what the last line is, I just wandered all over the place. Yeah. I'm like, well, I don't know where I'm going. It didn't work. So it's just a, you know, idiosyncrasy.
Now, have you ever had to change the last line?
I never have.
Really?
Never have.
Wow. So you're here in the South. What is it that you tell writers when you've only got a week?
Mm-hmm.
What do you say?
I've actually been talking about a piece of advice that the novelist Mona Simpson gave her students many years ago, which is to do some volunteer work along the way. And how is that writing advice? Well, it puts you in a right at the core of some kind of urgent experience, urgent need. You're doing something useful, but you're learning quickly about the what it looks like to be where there is nothing extraneous being discussed. You're just at the core of a something important.
When do you think writers? Do all writers need that kind of some kind of critical or and by that I mean a kind of an emergency, some upending, life-changing moment in their life to be a good writer?
I don't know that if they need it, but I don't know anyone who hasn't had at least one and usually many. So I wouldn't say you need it, but, you know, it's about in life and on the page, it's not what happens so much as what you make of it. Mm. You know, what of it?
Right.
What of it?
Well,
so,
and who hasn't had that kind of experience? I mean, we've all had.
Well, yes. And even if we haven't had it directly, you know, we're talking a few days after the quake in Japan and we're surrounded by, you know, that horror and consequences so it's always there in the culture, you know, in the society, if not in your own home and heart.
Amy Hempel, a pleasure to be able to interview you.
My pleasure.
Thank you for doing this. Amy Hempel is this year's Morgan Writer in Residence at UNC Chapel Hill. She's going to read tomorrow night, Wednesday night, the 16th at 6 o'clock, Carroll Hall on UNC's campus. The reading is free and open to the public. For information, englishcomplit.unc.edu. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.